Mitch Horowitz, welcome to Reenchantment.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Now, I have been following your work for a number of years, but have only recently taken a deep dive into it, especially a lot of the audiobooks that you have out, and you have many. And I've been pleasantly surprised by the kind of level of thinking and the value and usefulness of a lot of the ideas that you talk about and put out into the world. And today, you know, I want to focus on specifically the new thought, and specifically the one of kind of a new thought classic, or actually, I'm not even sure if it's considered a new thought, but it at least has many of the ideas. Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. So I'm going to let you take over from here and give a brief introduction, because I know you can do far better justice than I can, both to Napoleon Hill and his work, as well as to what new thought is more generally for those listeners who may not be familiar with it.
Sure. I would say Think and Grow Rich is probably a new thought adjacent work. It's not explicitly new thought, but it is very popular within that world. New thought is a movement that grew in the late 19th century out of the transcendental atmosphere of New England, among other places, and that held to and holds to the basic principle that thoughts are causative. So the new thought movement is what gave us the law of attraction, the power of positive thinking, manifesting the secret, and much else besides. And there is, in my estimation, a scale of quality within New Thought works. Some tend to really just go for the jugular of popularity, and some are more careful, more considered, and seek, as I attempt to really seriously address the question of whether thoughts have causative properties. That was a question that the American philosopher William James was very interested in. And since his death in 1910, although there have been many people that have popularized that idea very energetically and very popularly, I'm not altogether sure that the movement kept up in terms of its maturity and its own capacity for self-scrutiny with the pace of its own success. So that informs part of my work today. Enter Think and Grow Rich. Think and Grow Rich is a book that grew at least indirectly out of the New Thought movement. It's part of a great tradition of American success literature, and for many readers, myself included, it may be the best thing from a practical perspective that's come out of that literature. I say that Think and Grow Rich is New Thought adjacent rather than New Thought because it really is a program both of mental visualization, affirmation, suggestion, reconditioning, coupled with absolute concrete action. You can always tell whether or not someone has read Think and Grow Rich by where they fall on that question. The assumption, for example, as some journalists and critics will make, that Think and Grow Rich was a main source of inspiration behind The Secret is incorrect. I wouldn't run away from that, and I'm happy to address that question on different terms, because I think The Secret has become too much of a kind of universal punching bag, including for people who agree with some of its premises. But setting that aside, it is very different. Those two works, for example, are very different. Think and Grow Rich is very, very heavily action-oriented, very concrete, very outwardly focused, along with some of the inner premises about thought causation that you find running throughout the New Thought tradition.
Yeah, fantastic. I think you hit on a lot of major points to set the groundwork for this discussion. So thank you for that. I for many of the listeners of my podcast, I think mentioning a lot of these thinkers and texts can bring up certain feelings.
Yeah,
and I think it's important to address what you mentioned earlier, the ways in which, I guess many modern proponents of these ideas maybe haven't kept up with the level of sophistication that some of the early founders put into these theories and into this work. Could you name some of the maybe flimsier aspects of the modern New Thought movement and why people recoil at it?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and it's an important question to address head on, as you're doing. I'm very aware that when people hear things like manifesting or the secret or law of attraction or power of positive thinking, many critical people recoil. You know, they feel like those are typical examples, are cases in point of flimflam, of fuzzy thinking, of trendy new age soft-headedness. And I register that, and I understand that, and I also understand why people have those responses. But I use those terms so that everyone's reference points are clear. You know, I believe very strongly in not running away from very plain language. Now, in my work, I don't use terms like manifestation or law of attraction, not because I'm afraid of guilt by association or because I'm afraid of being misunderstood, so much as my outlook is different. And I won't go into that wholly, you know, right now, but I wrote a book called The Miracle Club, for example, which is a very practical, core, hands-on assessment of the question of thought causation. And for reasons that I go into very carefully in that book, I don't use the term manifestation, I use the term selection. And I have my point of view, and I have my reasons for using that language. I'm working on a new book right now called Daydream Believer, which I think goes even further than the Miracle Club did in terms of providing a really practical and yet at the same time very critical and very finely argued defense of the thought causation thesis, but also very stringent criticism of those expressions of that thesis within New Thought culture that are inadequate, in my estimation, that don't have a theology of suffering, that verge on attributing everything to one great mental super law, which is at the root of all human events, which I don't agree with. I've been very critical of The Secret, especially in my book One Simple Idea, which is a history of the positive mind movement, because I think that default to this notion of one mental super law or a law of attraction just doesn't cover the bases of life, either on an intimate scale or a macro scale, and we could all get into examples of that, and those examples are serious ones, and they should be heard, and they should be honored, and they need to be paid attention to. I think we live under, or at least we experience, many different laws and forces, and many different things condition experience, just like our experience of gravity is conditioned by mass, just like our experience of water is conditioned by temperature. Water is still H2O, but it can be a gas or a solid, depending upon climate. So there's no reason to assume that even if you agree with a premise, that premise is always going to express itself in the same way. I don't think New Thought as a movement has kept up with that. That's why I'm critical of it. And yet at the same time, I'm also part of it. You know, I do believe, for various reasons that I try to argue in my work, in talks, in books, in articles, I do believe that the thought causation thesis holds something very, very important for thinking, feeling, aspiring men and women. Absolutely. I also think it's been inadequately explored. So that's kind of where I dive into the pool and what I'm attempting.
So let's dig in. Let's dig into the thought causation thesis, and maybe how, you know, ways in which it is and can be applied. You know, I think in digging into maybe some of the mechanics of why a thought can be causative, we may differ. We may have differing ideas. I fall on the side of, you know, psychology and kind of ways in which thoughts express themselves and become real through material and non-supernatural means.
Yes.
I know you have you may agree with part of that. Maybe you have you know, ideas about, I know you have ideas about you know, extra-physical means or the potential.
Yes.
Potential of them existing.
Yeah.
And that's for me, that's almost beside the point. Because what I'm really interested in is the practical application.
Right, right.
Which I have experienced in my life, and I think regardless of how it works, I think it does work, and which is what I, you know, for listeners listening to this podcast, you know, whatever you think is actually going on, something is working here, and that's really the takeaway that I want people to get from this.
Yes, I agree, and I sort of emphasize pragmatics first and foremost, both colloquially and as a philosophical school. Does it work? Does it work? Is the resounding question that I have in my mind whenever facing any practical philosophy. Conduct is really the one empiricism that we have. Experience is the one empiricism that we have, and there are lots of things in modern life, recognized parts of treatment, therapy, that work without our fully understanding the mechanics behind it, including certain psychopharmacological drugs, SSRIs, SNRIs. You know, we have certain ideas of how these things work, but we're not altogether sure. And as with a patient in a hospital being asked on a chart of frowny faces to smiley faces to identify what level of pain he or she is experiencing, testimony matters. You know, testimony matters. You know, any individual who's ever visited a shrink and gotten put on a psychopharmacological drug, you know, there's tinkering, there's vastly individualized responses, there's a great deal of uncertainty, and sometimes through a period of trial and error, you might find the right thing, you know, or you might not. And it's very individualized. So I care very deeply about experience. I take experience very seriously.
But before we move on, I think it's important to mention that, you know, one of the ways in which kind of thoughts become actualized and concrete in the medical setting, long documented, is the placebo effect. And,
right.
You know, that's something that is very real. That's something that we know not only works, but actually over the decades has gotten stronger in the medical field with certain...
Absolutely. And it's very mysterious, you know. I mean,
and it's very mysterious.
Yeah, the things that we're finding in contemporary placebo studies, placebo surgeries, transparent placebos, the placebo being at work, even with active substances, in other words, how you feel about a pharmacologically active substance, will also affect its efficacy. Yeah. So we're seeing stuff in placebo studies that's rather mind-blowing, you know, compared to where the field was just after World War II, for example. And with regard to material means versus extra-physical means, I think our generation is in a world right now where materialism, which is to say the philosophy that holds to the argument that matter creates itself, essentially, and that there are basically Newtonian physical laws that explain life, and more or less that's that. I think materialism is in a state of crisis right now because we're seeing things happen around questions of non-local intelligence, interdimensionality, I'm referencing string theory, 90 years of quantum physics experiments, that so challenge Newtonian mechanics that eventually it's pushing us to ask questions about how or whether or to what extent these things are can be experienced in overt life, macro life, you know, not just in a particle lab somewhere, but in the experience of the recovering individual, for example. So I do care deeply, as you were alluding, about extra-physical questions, but I also honor the fact that I think that conditioning, suggestion, self-image, these things contribute to our experience seismically, you know, to a very great extent. There are countervailing forces in people's lives. I've never liked the expression, there are no accidents. I actually believe strongly there are, in fact, accidents, and terribly tragic ones as well as happy ones. But I do believe that we're, perhaps I'm being glib, you know, I do believe we live under a dynamic and a complexity of laws and forces, and we're going to experience that. But I think that self-image is the single, not the only, but the single greatest guarantee of where we're going to go in life.
Yeah, and so let's get down to some of the practicality. You know, what does it mean to that a thought is causative, and how might somebody how might somebody use that today, especially in the context of people are trying to restart and reshape their lives post the pandemic. How can you use this in a really practical way to actually achieve success, start a business, depart from your common path and find something that's passionately and alive and that you can succeed at?
Well, I will say this. The single greatest lesson I've taken from Think and Grow Rich, and I've been reading the book in a very dedicated way since 2013, and I've taken many lessons from it, and there are many aspects of Napoleon Hill's program that I believe are really effective. But the single greatest lesson that I've taken from it, and one that I think has made a very significant and positive difference in my life and my experience, is the idea of having one definite absolute aim. One absolute aim that you hold to like life itself, that is as important to you almost as drawing breath. And it's difficult. It's difficult because life places multiple demands on us. We're parents, we're caregivers, we're partners, we have all kinds of obligations that we have to fulfill at work, in our communities, to families. I feel all those same things. I have two adolescent sons. I have a partner. I am doing all kinds of things in my life. I have people who need me, and the measure of my life is in whether I show up for them to a great extent. At the same time, I really do believe that energy concentrated is a kind of a force. You know, one can understand that on many scales. You know, I'm not seeking to use flowery metaphors or metaphysical language. I mean, really and actually, so goes concentration, so goes force. You know, we see this in nature and we see it in the lives of individuals. Hmm. I think that absolutely holding to one aim, one definite, clear, specific aim that becomes the organizing principle of your existence is an enormous step in the direction of accomplishment. As I was referencing about self-image, I would say it is the single greatest, not the only, but the single greatest a guarantee of concretizing what you want in the world. And I would take that with deadly seriousness because it's tough. You know, it's tough. If you look at the lives of people you admire, whoever they may be, you know, you will find that they are remembered for, associated with, one overall thing. You know, whether it's Steve Jobs, you know, creating a generation of handheld devices, Nelson Mandela, you know, bringing democracy to South Africa, Winston Churchill, defeating fascism. You know, I'm reaching for bold-faced examples, but look at more private examples. Look at quieter examples. You know, look at the examples from your own existence. You know, to a very great extent, people who we wish to emulate or people who we see as having gotten to a certain pinnacle of achievement usually demonstrate exclusivity. Mm. And that's a tough bargain. That's a tough bargain because I'm the first to step up and say, I understand why people want to argue with that. I understand why we, all of us, everybody listening, has multiple obligations in his or her existence. So it seems like almost an unjust bargain. But I do think that that's the bargain life strikes with us. I do believe that if we hold very consciously and searchingly, not in some casual way, not in some childish way, not in some unexamined way, but with real maturity, intensity, and definition, if we hold to that one aim so clearly that you can write it down and put it, you know, in your pocket, which I encourage people to do. Here's my shop-worn card, my aim in my pocket, just so we can provide a little of empirical evidence that I'm talking about.
Could I ask you to share what that aim is?
I'll share it in general terms because it's very intimate, but it's basically writing, speaking, presenting on metaphysics in history and practice. You know, that is my aim. That is absolute for me. It's how I earn my living. It's how I have this roof over my head. It's everything in my existence, both in terms of satisfying me as an individual, but, as I was alluding earlier, also making me a productive figure in the lives of people I love, because one well-selected aim can cover a lot of bases. You know, how are kids being educated? How is healthcare being paid for? How are all the things in life that you as an individual, that your listeners as individuals are responsible for, being procured, while at the same time responding to whatever deep, deep yearning the individual feels in him or herself, whether that's getting an academic degree or starting a business or advancing through the ranks in the military or, you know, attaining something that's central to the individual's existence. Having one definite chief aim, and I mean being in dead seriousness about it. I mean being in dead seriousness about it in a mature, studied, scrutinizing way is immensely powerful. If people take one lesson from Napoleon Hill, take that one lesson. That's at the heart of Think and Grow Rich. There's much else there, but that's the central motivating point of the book.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I have this kind of image or this in my head of, like, you have a ball, and if you're pushing it in all different directions, 10 different directions over the course of a year, it's only going to move so far. It's going to kind of stay in the same place. But if you take all of your energies, all your forces, and you concentrate them in one direction, then that ball is going to move fast and it's going to move far. And, you know, it's...
Absolutely. And I see, you know, people anesthetize themselves with booze, with drugs, with OxyContin, with you know, watching shit hours on end, you know, online, et cetera, you know, debt spending, gambling, chronic shopping, whatever it is. You know, we're all part of that world, you know, when we all have our compulsions or our addictions. That stuff tends to get out of control when the individual feels a deep, deep emptiness in him or herself. Hmm. When the individual has proven unable to pursue or maybe even unaware of that thing that he or she wants. And it can be anything. You know, it doesn't have to fit somebody else's paradigm of what it should be. Mm. But I think that addictions and compulsions, they do get out of hand. They do become a substitute for what we experience when we hunger for that aim. And I hope, you know, that people listening to this will feel a sense of liberty. You know, I know that, for example, I don't know, some people hear, you work too much, you have to slow down, you have to chill out. Nobody on their deathbed ever wishes that he spent more time at the office. I'm not so sure that's true. You know, I mean, if you're into martial arts and that's your dedication, should someone tell you not to practice so much? You know, if you're starting a business, wow, you know, only an entrepreneur or a dedicated freelancer could fully understand the sense of self-realization that an individual feels, whether a restaurateur or an auto mechanic or whatever, in starting his or her own business. I mean, mm-hmm. that brings out things in people that you have to really experience in order to grok to empathize with, to understand. So work and life are in many ways one and the same, and I want to encourage people on that. I don't think it's unhealthy. I think it responds to a very deep-seated need. And if an aim is well chosen, it obviously facilitates the experience of other people.
Yeah. Yeah, I think right now it's so important as people are, you know, embarking on new paths in life and trying to create businesses out of, you know, their own passions, their own commitments to their own values, that you know, the importance of figuring out what that one thing is and really, like, just cutting away everything that is not that thing.
Yeah.
And it's hard. It's hard, as you mentioned, because we think, you know, the human person has, well, supposedly infinite potential, but there's, you know, while you can do anything theoretically, you can't do everything. And figuring out what that one thing is, waking up with it, going to sleep with it, you know, letting the mind work while you're sleeping on the problems that you face, it only can really happen and with that dedicated concentration and focus.
I agree. And it's tough medicine, you know, because it's not what we want to hear. We are raised in a world very often where we're taught that you should be well-rounded, you should relax, you should smell the daisies. And if people are more religiously oriented, depending on their religious outlook, they might feel that what I'm describing is in the downward direction, is in the direction of illusion or samsara or maya or whatever terminology you want to use. You know, that life is about non-attachment, non-identification, that life is about realizing one's higher nature. I think that's artifice, you know, to some extent. I think that self-realization, self-actualization, self-expression, I think it's very individualized, and I don't believe there are these lines of demarcation, in fact, between inner and outer and material and spiritual or attachment and non-attachment, you know, accomplishment in the outer world and accomplishment within. I know it's tempting to think that way because we live in a kind of binary culture and we think in terms of upper and lower, and we think in terms of opposing poles and forces and so on.
Holy and unholy.
Holy and unholy. Those are just words, you know. I mean, show me where personality would begin and essence would end, or vice versa. You know, show me where, you know, attachment begins and non-attachment ends. To my mind, it's about self-expression. The thing that averts personal crisis is self-expression. And when people are anesthetizing themselves through addiction or compulsion, including, you know, emotions that are destructive, you know, continual arguments, destructive relationships, usually what's going on is a terrible feeling of powerlessness, whether acknowledged or not, a terrible paucity of self-expression. And very often that expression does come through one's work or one's profession, whether a person is an artist or a financial administrator or an investor or a soldier or whatever it is, you know. And I think that self-expression is whole and doesn't necessarily submit to, you know, these different labels about, you know, higher or lower or material or spiritual, or you're spending too much time at work. I mean, if a person is spending too much time at work, well, I would ask, what are they getting out of it? And if they're unhappy, or if something in them is going awry, if they're experiencing a physical symptom or a mental symptom or sorrow or whatever it is, you know, I'd seek to get very specific about that. You know, maybe they feel a hunger for victory that they're not experiencing. You know, maybe it's that simple. You know, and I don't think we should run away from that. I don't think questions of victory and success and power and accomplishment are unspiritual. I think they're just markers that we use for self-expression and for the progressive attainment of one's wishes.
Yeah.
And I think a person's wishes are sacred, are real, are absolute. What else do we use to mark the human experience than asking, you know, what's around that hill over there? Can I get there?
Yeah. Yeah, and this is a really big hang up that people come across, and myself included. I've struggled with this for many years, and in many ways it's handicapped me for hamstrung me for many years. You know, material and worldly success feels in many ways the opposite of living a good, holy, spiritual life. This is an observation that or a thought that I had, that it feels as if on the left in the kind of democratic world, there's a similar kind of ethos and ethics at play, that the truly money and success, like, that is not the point. The point is these overarching ideals of fairness, equality, at the same time, you need that money, you need that power to actually put
sure.
in place a lot of the things that you want.
Absolutely.
Could you speak to that?
I think we need to bust up, you know, all these divisions and labels. You know, the notion that on one scale of polarity there's, material gain, money, attainment, resources, and on another scale of polarity there's somehow giving back and so on, and a more communal, justice-oriented point of view. I mean, an individual is going to feel all kinds of things in him or herself at all kinds of moments, and many of those things may coexist, you know, and I, it's funny, I'm working on a new book. It's called Cosmic Habit Force, and it is an exploration of an idea originated by Napoleon Hill. That's his phrase. Mm-hmm. And I'm examining, you know, this question of cosmic habit force, which is supposed to be cultivating habits that bring you into alignment with the natural flow of reality, of cycles, of the natural world. It's kind of like an application of transcendentalism, we'll say.
Anyway, reminds me of Taoism as well.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And so as I'm exploring this, you know, I come across an article, or rather, it gets sent to me by a friend from Inc. magazine, and I critique this article in the forthcoming book. The article is a roundup of studies into goals, and I always find that these studies conducted by social scientists into goals, into positive psychology, very frequently, if you really get into the nitty-gritty of the studies themselves, you know, sit down and read the studies versus reading the news coverage of the studies, you may come away with some very heavy questions about how these things are designed, about whether they measure anything, about the brevity of some of these studies. I mean, some of them last 2 weeks. They involve a handful of people.
Yeah.
You know, the methodology is questionable. Social scientists are always interested in taking a magnifying glass to some of the things we're talking about, and very often negatively, but I question their capacity to understand and apply some of these issues within the framework of their studies. So I've been critical of some of these studies in my books, and I will apparently be again. Anyway, so I'm reading this news coverage of this study of how to apply goals, and there's several such studies, and I read each one of them, and I critique a couple in the book. And one of the takeaways is that you're more likely to attain a goal if there is a certain meaning attached to it, which sounds benign enough, and then you get into the examples of meaning. Well, let's say you want to earn a lot of money. You're more likely to attain that goal, according to one study, which I thought was very flimsy, and I'll go into my reasons why in the book. But anyway, that was the premise. You're more likely to attain your goal of earning a lot of money if you attach meaning to it. For example, wanting to send kids to college or give back to your community or do this or do that. And I read that, and I really had to raise an eyebrow, because we have to be real with one another. You know, life doesn't last forever. And, you know, whether one has a more material view or a more immaterial view, there's never been an exception to mortality. And we're hanging around here for a limited period of time. So we have to be real. I've met a lot of people who have been hungry to earn money. Never once have I ever met anybody who sincerely related his or her wanting to earn money in order to give back, you know, to the community. That might be a byproduct, and I'll be first in line to shake your hand. But let's be real. Let's be concrete. You know, people earn money because they want to improve their circumstances, because they want to care for people they love, and they want to buy health insurance, and they want to keep a roof over their head, and they want to fix the mold that, you know, makes them put yellow police tape across the door to their den, and they want to do all kinds of things that are critically and vitally important to them. And they may, in fact, want to buy a Tesla or do something else. You know, we have to be starkly real with ourselves about what we want. You're not going to get power from perfuming things. You're not going to get power. You're not going to get influence. You're not going to feel a sense of selfhood and attainment if you feel social pressure, whether from an article or a study or from somebody like me or whatever it is, to disguise your aims. And I think that, in fact, people who are on the more left side of the spectrum would benefit from rediscovering some of this literature and not saying, oh man, that's just a sham for capitalism or whatever. It's like, is it? Look really carefully, because there's a woman who is about to become the mayor of the city of Buffalo here in New York State where I live, who's a democratic socialist, who speaks in terms, and I applaud it, about self-belief and about having a goal and about knowing who you are and moving in the direction of what you wish for with absolute unrestrained belief in your capacity to expand and to grow. And I'm reading this and I'm thinking, well, right on. Her goal was to become mayor of Buffalo, New York. She's a whisker away from achieving that because she won the Democratic primary and is almost certainly likely
to be
a shoo-in. The name escapes me. You know, it's easily found. And I thought to myself, well, that's a very valid, concrete goal. I mean, that's gonna change the political climate of our culture to a certain extent. And the verbiage that she's using sounds a lot like the very things that we're talking about. So I'd say to the individual, this is about concretizing ideas. Whatever your ideas are, whatever you're after, whatever you wish for, you do yourself a disservice if you don't at least demonstrate the curiosity to check out a book like Think and Grow Rich, because there's stuff in there that you may find services, you know, your wishes in ways that are dramatic and that are remarkable. You know, I said that I've been reading it, forgive me, I'll pause in one sec. I said I've been reading Think and Grow Rich since 2013. I felt great uncertainty in my life at that time, and so even though I was aware of Think and Grow Rich and I had been dipping my toe in it, I hadn't really done the program in a heartfelt way, in a comprehensive way. And I went into it, and it did change things for me very dramatically. And when I meet friends who are suffering and who feel like everywhere they turn, there are doors being slammed in their face, and they're very depressed or they're very anxious, I very frequently give them a copy of Think and Grow Rich, and I said, look, you know, I'll make a deal with you. You know, I'm giving this thing to you. I really want you to try it. I guarantee you, you will feel a greater sense of happiness, power, agency, ability in your life, provided you do the exercises in this book as though your life depends upon it. You do these exercises as though your life depends upon it, whatever your goal may be, whatever your values. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You'll feel forward motion. I've never seen an exception to it, but it can't be approached casually. That's also part of the bargain.
Yeah. It requires an intensity. It requires a commitment. It requires, you know, as you point out, a kind of really it needs emotion. It needs excitement and enthusiasm. It needs like emotional teeth. And you know, so thinking about why the secular movement, people who are very skeptical about the extra physical, you know, why many I think have turned away and continue to turn away from this literature, is it's actually kind of baffling to me, because when I read of the works that I've read so far, it is so easy for me to read them from a materialist lens. It is so easy for me to look at them, you know, and see in them, not all the books, but in many of them, a kind of cognitive therapy that is at work, and you know, understanding that look, we don't know so much about how the mind works, and the subconscious mind is this black box that is constantly, you know, producing, you know, our thoughts, our instincts, all of these aspects that we need to respect this mystery. And we also need to realize that there are people, especially in the religious and spiritual traditions, that have been utilizing the subconscious, I think, for millennia to achieve, you know, to achieve their goals, to pray and actually see things happen and see things change their emotional attitudes towards their lives or the world. And I think that there is a huge, huge potential for, I think, the humanist, the secular, the agnostic, you know, even the atheist movements, to look at this literature and say, look, you know, maybe we're not so sure about the extraphysical stuff, but there is real practical psychology here that can be used to heal, transform, and to achieve. And that is something that I don't really see much in the secular world.
I agree. I mean, I think those are all really good points. There's literature that comes out of the New Thought tradition that is secular. And if so, a person takes a more secular view of life. One of my heroes is Emile Coué, who is a French mind theorist who was one of the pioneers of autosuggestion or use of affirmations, and his work has indirectly affected a lot in the way of placebo studies. There was a cosmetic surgeon, now deceased, named Maxwell Maltz, who in 1960 wrote a book called Psycho-Cybernetics, which is, it's secular new thought. It's secular new thought. And then you have more contemporary figures like, you know, Anthony Robbins, for example, who I would say is also probably secular new thought. To a degree, you could fit Napoleon Hill in that category. I mean, you'll find in Think and Grow Rich, without question, extra material, extra physical ideas, you know, questions of clairvoyance, ESP, sixth sense, mastermind, infinite intelligence, and yet at the same time, it is really possible to go through that book from a cognitive perspective and say, you know, this is what I believe is going on. So I embrace that. You know, it's not strictly my point of view. My point of view, as you alluded, is towards the, when I say spiritual, I really mean extra physical. And I take that very seriously, and I think that some of those boundaries are kind of morphing and collapsing and melting into one another, the secular and the material versus the, I don't know, extra physical and the spiritual are not as easily demarcated nowadays as I think they were perhaps a generation or two ago. So I would encourage the individual who doesn't think in spiritual terms and who maybe is not even attracted to such ideas to check out some of this literature, because it does avail itself to you even in material terms. And psychocybernetics is a favorite example. It's all about autosuggestion and reconditioning the mind. And William James used to make the observation that, look, if it wasn't for a maybe, if it wasn't for a self-belief, if it wasn't for being on the positive side of a maybe, nothing would be possible for the individual at all. It is not a guarantee. It is not a guarantee. But absent the coming out on the positive side of maybe, there is a guarantee in the negative that an individual will not attempt, will not achieve, and will not even know what would have happened had he or she done so. So self-belief is critical. I would say it is not the only game in town, but it's absolutely critical. And I would also say, you know, and I'm aware that in magazines, in journals, online, you know, studies will bubble up from the social science world every now and again that actually setting goals is retrograde, or actually positive thinking deters your aims, or, you know, I remember there was a piece in the New Yorker a few years ago called The Powerlessness of Positive Thinking, and I thought, well, bravo, great headline, sounds compelling. And if people feel like it, in my book, The Miracle Club, I go through the studies that were popularly written about in that piece, which were, again, studies from the social sciences that sought to demonstrate that positive mind mechanics is actually a deterrent. I question that, and I question those studies, and I think that the social science world is more often coming from a place of cultural prejudice than an actual place of ability in evaluating some of these ideas. And I'm very explicit about that in the Miracle Club, because I think that the philosophy of self-belief is something to which I've dedicated myself. I care about it a great deal. And if there's a critique about it, I want to know that critique. But that critique has to come from a place that is more compelling or as compelling as the original idea itself. And I've never found that.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I read that the critiques you had of that article, and I thought they held water. And you know, to relate a kind of, you know, a personal story, or not quite my own, but in New Orleans, the mother of these two boys that I mentor, she is as a single mother and has two businesses that she started and is an entrepreneur, and you know, I have been immensely impressed by what she's been able to achieve with her efforts and her energies. And I remember walking in, and I saw, and like, she had a whiteboard on the wall, and she had written again and again and again, like, the amount of money that she wanted to earn by, like, you know, some date. And this was before I kind of, you know, encountered any of your literature, but I remember it really struck me, like, you know, if you write it again and again, if you hammer that into your mind, you know, it's not nothing. You're conditioning yourself. You're, you know, creating this. You're focusing your mind like a magnifying glass to achieve, to find a way across, you know, obstacles and make opportunity where there may be none, or very, very slim opportunity. And I know that for this family, there isn't a lot of opportunity, but she has found ways to lift them up, and they live a good life right now. It's because of her, and it's because of her drive and her, you know, her whatever techniques that she has been using to elevate herself and her children.
Absolutely. And these things are very personal. And one has to be in proximity to them. You know, there's no amount of field work that substitutes for relationship. You know, you have to be there. You have to judge from your own conduct, your own experience. You have to be face-to-face with people. It's a very sensitive thing. It's kind of like addiction recovery. You know, there's no outside experience of an addiction recovery program that will fully disclose its peaks and valleys to you than absolute proximity. It's hard to measure these things. You know, social scientists have had a hard time measuring Alcoholics Anonymous, for example, which has been around since the late 1930s. You know, if somebody exits the program, do you count that as a failure? How do you follow them? If people stick with the program and they are overwhelmingly successful, does that say something about, you know, AA's program per se, or does that say something more about the motivation and the stick-to-itiveness of the individual or the interior culture of the program? You know, it's not easy. Mm. It's not easy to study the cause and effect of a practical philosophical ideal in a person's life, because you're depending on their own individualized sense of experience and conduct with that idea over long periods of time. You know, my life, like everybody else's listening, is like a bar graph that's going to go up and down in terms of satisfaction. But it occurred to me at a certain point, with almost the force of an epiphany, that I'm living out in middle age at this moment things that I fantasized about when I was very, very, very young. Almost at so young an age that it's the point at which you begin to form your first long-term memories, your first memories, ideas, dreams, mental pictures that you remain cognizant of. Those things may remain in your psyche, but it was at that young age, 4 or 5 years old, where you start to have images that you can recollect, that stay with you consciously throughout life. And I realized the unbelievable, surprising, and almost uncanny arc of those decades of experience. And if you had asked me 20 years ago, are you living out what you want, you would have gotten a very uneven answer. Hmm. If you asked me today, are you living out what you want, you would get a yes. With other things toward which I'm pushing, but that yes didn't reveal itself without the benefit of time. So one has to be with this kind of program for a while sometimes, at least in my experience.
Yeah. Well, for those listening, and want to find out more about this body of literature, about New Thought and New Thought adjacent works, what's something besides Think and Grow Rich that they could read that would be a good primer, either from the traditional New Thought literature or maybe even from your own body of work?
Well, I was thinking of this just a moment ago. A good primer would be a lecture that is available free on YouTube called The Strangest Secret by a man named Earl Nightingale. Hmm. Earl was a radio broadcaster who in 1956, I think, recorded a vinyl album called The Strangest Secret, and it's now been, you know, thanks to the wonders of digital technology, pirated all over the world, and it can be listened to for free online. And it's a really good, solid, grounding argument, secular-based, on behalf of the New Thought thesis, the thought causation thesis. I would also, if people are interested, I would encourage them to check out my book, One Simple Idea, which is a history of the positive mind movement, and it really weighs out very critically, both historically and from a practical perspective, a lot of the issues you and I have been discussing, and also the Miracle Club. But if you want to dip your toe in the pool and say, you know, what is this philosophy, I recommend Earl Nightingale's lecture, The Strangest Secret. Very brief, maybe it's about 40 minutes or so. I don't agree with everything Earl says. I don't agree with all of his emphases. I don't agree with his historicism necessarily, but it really is compelling, it really is persuasive, and it was an inspiration to me.
Excellent. Awesome. I will try and put links to that in the text, but I think, honestly, people can just look it up on YouTube. I think that's the easiest
way. Yeah, Stranger Secret. Easy to find. Yeah.
Well, Mitch, thank you so much. I hope people have taken something from this, and the one thing, right, that we're talking about is just a total obsessive, white-hot desire for whatever that one aim is, figuring what that is, and just concentrating all of our focus towards it. Is that a fair summary of?
I think it's a fair summary, and I would ask the individual if that idea intrigues you, if that idea appeals to you. It's an experiment, you know. It's also just something to try. It's not as if the door swings only in one direction and not in the other direction.
Sure.
If you, you know, decide that we're wrong, you know? but try it and be really disciplined with yourself. And you know, people make fun of people writing things down on index cards and so on. Well, I say, you know, I'm really grateful for index cards. I found that, you know, index cards have probably gotten more things done in this world than a lot of empty talk over beer, you know, in a bar somewhere. You know, be disciplined with yourself. Go all the way, you know, sit down in private in an unembarrassed way and ask yourself what that aim would be. And it's just an experiment. You don't have to talk to anybody about it. You know, try it and see if it makes sense.
Yeah, I think that's really great advice, Mitch. Thank you again for coming on the show.
Sure.
And,
my pleasure.
And best of luck with your work and your writing.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Take care.